For decades, the beautiful natural features of Glen Canyon were buried underwater, under Lake Powell, one of the largest reservoirs in the country. But now it's shrinking to the point it's getting really close to these markers, these stages where Powell cannot do what it was built to do, that is, generate power and distribute water as part of an arrangement called the Colorado River Compact. Those stages have names like Minimum Power Pool and Dead Pool. But one of the things that's happened as the reservoir has receded is that some of those features have been uncovered. And last year, an NPR reporter named Nathan Rott wanted to see some of them. He called Eric Balkin. He's the executive director of the Glen Canyon Institute. And Balkin had just the place in mind.
Cathedral in the Desert is a large chamber of sandstone. The walls are about 500 feet tall. At the end of it, there's a 60-foot waterfall that falls into a calm, cold little pool. The ceiling of it is kind of this S-shaped sliver in the sky, and if you spend a couple hours in there, you'll see this sunlight dance. The light begins by creeping over on the side of the wall as a faint sliver, and it slowly peels across this one wall of the chamber. It lights up the back of the waterfall, and it does this little light show. It lasts for a few hours, and then it's gone. Before the dam was built, to see Cathedral, you would pull off at the Escalante River, which is a tributary to the Colorado. You would hike up, I think, about 4 miles to Clear Creek. Then you would hike up Clear Creek through a canyon filled with willows and cottonwood trees, seeping walls of water, hanging gardens. Finally, you would reach this end chamber. You could hear the waterfall in the background before you got there. Cathedral in the Desert was inundated by the waters of Lake Powell in the late 1960s, and over the course of time as the reservoir filled up, it was ultimately covered by over 100 feet of water. You would boat your motorboat right into the chamber, and then you'd land on this bank of sand, and you were kind of in it. Since 2005, Cathedral has come out of water about 5 or 6 times in brief intervals, and then it would go back underwater as the reservoir came back up. Last year was the first time that you actually had to walk into it. I brought Nathan Rott in there, and I was explaining the significance of walking into the cathedral, and I was walking into the chamber, and to the right side is a 30-foot wall of sediment that's left behind from the reservoir. I'm craning my head up to look at the top of the sediment shelf, and I see this huge 6-point buck deer looking down at me with a tilted head. I blinked and I thought I was hallucinating. I almost couldn't believe my eyes. There was a huge buck deer in here. What was uncommon about this is that there's no way in or out of Cathedral in the Desert without either rappelling down a 60-foot waterfall or boating in. I looked back to Nate and I was like, dude, you see that? Like, come up here. And he was like, yeah, I see it. And the thing bolted. We hiked up on top of the sediment pile and looked for it, and it was gone. And when we boated out of there later, there was no trace of it. It was such a surreal experience. For me, it was just a reminder that this place is much, much more than these human stories and what it means to us people visiting it. It's a wild place, and nature is reclaiming it. I look at it like this. We have huge challenges in the Colorado River Basin. Huge challenges. But we also have a huge opportunity in Glen Canyon, a place that, by all rights, should have never been dammed. If we had any environmental laws in the U.S. in the 1950s, it wouldn't have been dammed. Many consider it to be a huge mistake, the greatest environmental mistake in our country's history. Now we're being given a chance to see these features and these canyons come back to life.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So the condition of Lake Powell is part of what Eric Balkin describes as a larger embroiled history of water use in the West. And this past spring, he wrote a piece for the Deseret magazine where he explored the history of Lake Powell and the questions that water managers and leaders are facing now that the reservoir is at its lowest point since it was first filled in the late 60s. Now, Balkin is an advocate, so he clearly has his own solution in mind. He thinks there's actually a way to decommission the Glen Canyon Dam and reimagine Lake Powell as some kind of monument. But he's also realistic, and his article is a fair assessment of the options in play. We started the conversation with Glen Canyon itself, the focus of his life's work, which he describes as the physical and metaphorical heart of this story.
If you think about just geographically where it is, it's right below Canyonlands National Park. It's right above Grand Canyon National Park. To the west, we have Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. To the east, we have Bears Ears National Monument. All of these world-renowned protected places. Right in the middle of all of this is Glen Canyon. It was the coming together of many of the tributary rivers of the Colorado Plateau. It's right below the confluence of the Green and the Colorado, the confluence of the San Juan, the Escalante, the Dirty Devil River, not to mention the 125 side canyons that were feeding into this place. John Wesley Powell, who famously explored the area, wrote about it in a sort of ethereal way where it was, you know, pleasant and relaxing and wondrous spires and gorges and grottos and waterfalls and arches and bridges. You know, the place was more than worthy of being a national park, more than worthy. Wallace Stegner said that famously. He said this would have made a superb national park.
And what do you think it meant? I mean, we can only speculate here, but what do you think it meant for people anciently? Because this is something you mention in your writing, to the people who inhabited that area hundreds, thousands of years ago. What do we know about what it meant to them? We know it was home.
It was home, yeah. You know, they clearly had a deep connection to it. And the cultural and archaeological resources in Glen Canyon are so many that clearly it was attractive to humans for over 10,000 years. There's so much evidence of human activity down there prehistorically. So clearly it was special, right? Clearly there was a reason why so many people were drawn there. And it was a very inviting place. If you think about a place that you wanted to live on in the Colorado Plateau, what would be better than a kind of easygoing, peaceful river with a bunch of perennially flowing streams going in? I mean, you know, the potential for farming and cultivation down there, I think, was really good, which is why I imagine so many humans lived there for thousands of years. And of course, the modern Native Americans who still call it home, the Navajo, the Hopi, the Paiute, the Zuni, Pueblo, they do have connections to those ancestral Puebloans. And so those ancient people who lived there are connected to the indigenous people who still call it home today.
Settlement from European explorers and settlers comes, you've mentioned 1776. There's Dominguez and Escalante, of course. Mormon settlers arrive in the mid-1800s, 1880s, something like that. What did that that region offer in the way of natural resource value? I'm sure they thought it had possibilities.
There was a lot of speculation in Glen Canyon in regards to its potential for natural resource value. There was efforts to mine gold and uranium and oil. Most of those didn't pan out, pun intended. Yeah. There was a few famous examples like the Stanton Dredge, and you know, people were schlepping all this big industrial machinery down there in the hopes that they could establish some sort of natural resource extraction, and most of it failed for the most part.
But when it really took off, it seems, at least for white people, is when the canyon is discovered by river runners, I guess. That's when a new kind of value seems to take hold.
Right. So in the 1950s, river rafting, I guess the version that we know today, that's kind of when it was born, right? They were using all this old surplus military gear. When you look at the photos, it's a bit laughable today. They have these kind of janky setups of strapped together pontoon boats. And Glen Canyon was the perfect place for that because there weren't any serious rapids. It wasn't like Cataract upstream that was really demanding white knuckle whitewater rapids, right? You had to be a good boater to make it through that. And downstream in the Grand Canyon, of course, is the same thing. In Glen Canyon, it was a fun, playful river. And so a lot of guide companies kind of cut their teeth there. And on the San Juan River, it was perfect for that.
When does this idea of a dam, when is that first conceived? When is it first proposed?
Well, it's hard to say exactly when the idea of Glen Canyon Dam was officially first proposed because the idea had been bouncing around as early as the 1920s. And a bit more seriously in the 1930s and the 1940s. And the reason behind that was upper basin states. The Colorado River Basin is divided into an upper basin and a lower basin. And there's a requirement that the upper basin deliver or not impede water from flowing down to the lower basin. And the upper basin states were looking at California. California in the early 1900s was developing water very quickly. They were building these huge canals, irrigating large swaths of land, really starting to develop a lot of that river, which is why they have the biggest share of the river today, right? That's the way the law of the river works. Yep. First in time, first in right.
Yep.
And upper basin states and lawmakers in Utah and Colorado were looking at this development in California, and they were saying to themselves, if we don't have a way to catch some water up here in the upper basin, we'll never have a chance to grow. Because at the time, the populations in Utah and Colorado and Wyoming were very minuscule compared to California. And they recognized that water was the key to growth. And there was this big fear and animosity between the upper basin and the lower basin. And so they felt that they needed to be able to impound water upstream so that California didn't develop at all before they had a chance.
So this is something that you mention in your piece, that the dam, the Glen Canyon Dam, essentially Lake Powell, what was the plan for that? Because you mention the water of Lake Powell, it didn't ever actually irrigate fields or supply water for these developing cities in the West.
That's right. Yeah, counter to what a lot of people think, the purpose of Glen Canyon Dam is to store excess water for the upper basin and to deliver a legal amount downstream to meet that legal delivery obligation. So the construction site of the Glen Canyon Dam is the dividing line between the upper and lower basin. I think David Brower might have said it best. David Brower describes Glen Canyon Dam as a very expensive way of letting water flow downstream.
We should explain who David Brower is. He was, one of the founders of the Sierra Club.
He wasn't a founder of the Sierra Club, but he was the executive director for 19 years, I believe.
Right.
He was well known for taking the Sierra Club from an organization that, you know, was, I think, 5 or 10,000 and growing it into a national powerhouse. It was the first national scale environmental organization that actually had power. And David Brower was involved in some fights to protect Echo Park upstream on the Green River. And the story goes, which of course is kind of gets fudged a little bit, but he led a very successful public campaign against the dam in Dinosaur National Monument in Echo Park, and rallied the public behind it. It was the first time an environmental group had stopped a dam. It was a very big deal. And in part of those negotiations was that if the Bureau of Reclamation didn't build a dam in Dinosaur, they wouldn't oppose a higher Glen Canyon dam downstream in Glen Canyon.
Right? It was kind of a compromise that he made on some level that he would sort of grant – they wouldn't fight that hard for a Glen Canyon dam if they would rethink the Echo Park.
Right?
Is it something like that?
And the Bureau says that they were always going to build a Glen Canyon dam, but they were kind of on this compromise that if they did Echo Park Dam, then they would build a lower version of Glen Canyon Dam that we know today, and they'd kind of divvy up the water storage that way. David Brower, of course, had never been to Glen Canyon. He never saw it until after this negotiation was made, and all these people came to him and they said, "What the hell are you doing? You have to see this place." And again, Roy Webb, our friend from the archives, reminds me all the time that there was this book from the Sierra Club published called The Place No One Knew. And he always jokes that it's the place David Brower didn't know. Because lots of people knew Glen Canyon.
Yeah.
There were dozens and hundreds and I think thousands of people running that river down there. I read an account somewhere that said there were more people running the river in Glen Canyon than there were in the Grand Canyon because it was a lot easier to do. Mm. And importantly, there were Native American people living in Glen Canyon, right? Homes and farms and orchards and pastures. You know, this this was a very well-known place to some people, just not to David Brower. So that part of the story sometimes gets overlooked.
But what happens when he does see it? His heart must have dropped.
Yeah. So when Brower finally sees Glen Canyon, he realizes the gravity of his mistake. He goes on to call it the biggest mistake of his life. And to his credit, he documented it. He wrote about it. He spent, you know, he made, I think, 6 trips down there at that point. And he went on to help form a little organization called Glen Canyon Institute, of which I now get the pleasure to run.
Yeah. All right. So let's get to the point where they build the dam and we start to see something that now is described as Lake Powell, this big reservoir. What were the – give us a sense of the scale of this project. It's really massive.
It's a huge project, and it was really kind of the crowning achievement of the Bureau of Reclamation for that post-World War II era. The Colorado River Storage Project Act, which was authorized in 1956, it authorizes Glen Canyon Dam, Flaming Gorge, Blue Mesa, Navajo Dam, all these big water projects in the Upper Basin.
And this is the crown jewel in that project.
Yes. Glen Canyon is going to be the biggest facility for all of those. And its hydropower would generate revenue that would help pay for the construction, the operation, and maintenance of all these other facilities in the Upper Basin. And for Floyd Dominey, the commissioner of reclamation at that time, this was his beauty project, right? This was the most important project for him.
It takes 17 years to fill Lake Powell, which gives you a sense of just how big this was. Backs up nearly 200 miles of the Colorado River.
Yeah, the scale of this reservoir is almost hard to wrap your head around. I mean, many of your listeners have visited Lake Powell and they've boated on it, and many of them probably saw it when it was full. It's kind of like an inland sea almost. Yeah. It's so big you almost couldn't explore all of it if you wanted to. The construction began in 56, took 6 or so years to build. They closed the gates in 1963 and it begins filling. And even though in the early days, they let just a trickle downstream through the Grand Canyon, they still have to allow this river to flow downstream, right? Remembering that this dam is built to catch excess water.
Yeah.
So it takes 17 years to fill up because it's only catching the excess flow beyond what we have to deliver downstream.
So we should mention that there was a time, you write about this in your piece, that there was a lot of water, like there was plenty of water. And in some periods, almost too much.
Right. So in the 60s and 70s, the reservoir is filling up. And then we get to the 80s, and we start to see these series of very wet years. Yes. Of course, 1983 is this famous flood year. Kevin Fedarko writes about it in The Emerald Mile. Glen Canyon Dam almost topples over from overflowing with water. And we get a second year, 1984, that's a similar historic flood year. I mean, just astronomical amounts of water. There was flooding all over the place. It was biblical. And it also made folks realize this limitation of our human engineering, because we were so close to losing Glen Canyon Dam. And I think even Fedarko might underplay it slightly. I mean, I've heard people say that we were really just a couple days away from losing that whole structure, which is kind of scary. I mean, obviously, I want to see Glen Canyon restored, but we don't want to see it restored like that. You know, there are limitations to what human engineering can do.
When does the sort of climate tide start to turn? When does it become apparent that water in the West is slowing, starting to diminish?
The reality that we know today, which we are calling the new normal, this begins in the year 2000, right? In 1999, Lake Powell is basically 100% full. Lake Mead is right there with it. A series of dry winters starts to bring the level of the reservoir down. And honestly, at that time, water managers were relieved. It's kind of hard to wrap your head around that now, but water managers were relieved in the early 2000s when we finally got some dry years, because it was pretty wet throughout the 80s and 90s. And it offered a little bit of respite. And at that time, the basin states had just finished the surplus guidelines, this agreement about what to do with all this extra water. A lot of it goes to California, of course. And that's where the basin was at. They were relieved to have some dry years. They had just come to an agreement about what to do with all the excess water. And really, it didn't become real until, I think, 2004 and 2005. Lake Powell, in the course of 5 years, goes from like 98% full to 34% full.
This conversation really takes a turn in 2008. There's a study called When Will Lake Mead Go Dry, which starts to make a real difference. Talk about this study and explain why Lake Mead matters in the scheme of things, because there's the connection there I think people need to understand.
Yeah. So in 2008, the Scripps Institute study comes out, When Will Lake Mead Go Dry? Lake Mead, of course, is the sister reservoir to Lake Powell. Yeah. Lake Mead is the biggest reservoir in the country. Lake Powell is the second biggest reservoir in the country. Lake Mead is the main reservoir for the lower basin states, and Lake Powell is the main reservoir for the upper basin states. And the current operating criteria for these two behemoth reservoirs is they should be roughly equal most of the time. They should be – but after all these incredible drought years, really, I mean – To see that reservoir crash from almost full down to one-third capacity in just a few years was really eye-opening to a lot of people. And, you know, it almost is taken as scripture now that climate change is reducing flows. But at the time, people didn't necessarily believe that.
And it was freaking them out.
I think it was upsetting them. It was freaking some people out. Yeah. But I think for other people, these studies were seen as an annoyance. You know, I know for a fact that there were folks at the Bureau of Reclamation whose feathers were ruffled by this study, because it called into question their ability to control this river. The Bureau of Reclamation's job is to manage water in the West, and the study was saying, hey, you're not going to be able to manage water in the West if this climate change thing really pans out like we think it will. And what's so remarkable about that Scripps study is that if you look at what they were modeling and what they were projecting – and where we are today in 2022, it was hauntingly accurate. They were saying that Lake Powell and Lake Mead are going to be mostly dry most of the time. And that's turned out to be true.
Do you think that this was kind of a rude awakening, I guess, for Western water managers, leaders, developers? Was this the first real sense, the Scripps study and some of the other ones right around that time, that water actually is going to be finite, that this is going to be – I mean, people had been talking about that for a long time, but maybe was this one of the first actual realizations that there is a limitation of water in the West?
I think it was a realization for some stakeholders.
Yeah.
Look at Nevada. Nevada has the smallest portion of Colorado River water. They are allocated 300,000 acre feet. It's a pretty small amount. And because of that, they have always been very smart with water. All of their municipalities essentially run off of reused water. It's kind of incredible, honestly. And so they have always paid very close attention to these climate studies. They have been very proactive. They famously built their third straw into Lake Mead. Well, you know, in the Upper Basin, we have lawmakers who are questioning the reality of climate change or what the impacts could be. They were making plans to build a water intake that comes from river level at Lake Mead. That's how scared they were about what was going to happen to the river.
Eric Balkin, he's the executive director of the Glen Canyon Institute. His article about the future of Glen Canyon and Lake Powell appeared in the May issue of the Deseret magazine. You can find a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Listeners can hear KUER on the radio across Utah. Beyond the dial, there are many ways to stay connected to NPR Utah. Enjoy our free live stream at KUER.org. Take us wherever you go with the KUER mobile app. And if you have a smart speaker, find us there, too, by saying play KUER. Explore all the ways to stay connected at KUER.org/listen.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Lake Powell and Glen Canyon. As our guest, the environmental advocate Eric Balkin, says Glen Canyon effectively is Lake Powell. But that reservoir, which took 17 years to fill and backed up nearly 200 miles of the Colorado River, is shrinking drastically. The surface area of Powell is about a third of what it once was. And Balkin, who's the executive director of the Glen Canyon Institute, says whatever you think about Lake Powell, it's time to make some difficult choices. Because if it can't generate power in the way it used to, if it can't deliver the water it was built for, what do? Do we phase it out, use it occasionally as a holding tank, or do we reimagine it as a national park or a monument and let the river flow around it? Either way, Balkin told us features and rapids once buried by the reservoir are now reemerging, giving a sense of both new possibilities and revealing just how dry it is down there. Balkin wrote about all of this in a recent edition of the Deseret magazine. The piece is called When the Desert Runs Dry. All right, so let's fast forward to Lake Powell today. Tell us where we are now. And give us a sense of – there are all these terms that I want people to be able to understand.
Yeah.
Minimum power pool, dead pool. Just give us a sense of where that reservoir, that lake is now.
Right. So when Glen Canyon Dam was constructed, the intakes to the hydropower turbines were built at elevation 3370. The lowest level that those can actually be used is 20 feet above that. That's 3490. 3490 is what we call minimum power pool. Once you go below that, those power generators can't be used. Once you get so close to those hydropower intakes, the potential for air bubbles to get into the turbines creates this huge risk. They can't run them. Air bubbles could get in there and they'll break. It's also worth noting that those hydropower intakes are the main mechanism for actually moving water downstream. So it's not just about hydropower. Huh. There's a very important water delivery component that we lose once we go below 3490. And right now, today, we are just about 45 feet above that level. And Lake Powell is dropping, and it's going to drop to within 15 feet of that level next spring, most likely. Below minimum power pool.
Yeah.
The next way that water can get out of Glen Canyon Dam are through what's called the river outlet works. There are four smaller holes at the lower part of the dam, elevation 3370. So we're about 237 feet above the original floor of the river.
Wow.
And that is the lowest level at which water can get out of Glen Canyon Dam. And it really can't release a lot of water, these river outlet works. They weren't built to be the main water transportation mechanism for Glen Canyon Dam. Glen Canyon Dam was not built to operate at low levels. It was optimized for the time of excess, right? Going back to what we were saying earlier, Glen Canyon Dam was built to harness excess water. The constructors, the engineers of this dam never contemplated this future where we would have such low flows on the Colorado River. And so now we have all these huge questions about what happens when we start operating Glen Canyon Dam at these low levels. Glen Canyon Institute, my organization, for the past decade or so, we were proposing an alternative we called Fill Meet First. Basically, the idea was if Glen Canyon Dam was this huge mistake and we lost this incredible canyon and there was no longer enough water to fill both of these reservoirs, then fill Lake Mead first and give Glen Canyon a chance to come back. That was the idea behind it. And where we are now is that you can't even fill Lake Mead. If you were to draw Lake Powell down to Deadpool today, Lake Mead would barely be above 50% full. Wow. And these scenarios that we were hypothesizing in our Fill Mead First proposal, we are hitting those unintentionally now. And for a long time, we were saying, hey, we should study these, you know, management scenarios because there might come a day that it makes sense for us to actually try to operate the dam at lower levels. And it was largely ignored by decision makers. Now we're in a place where I think there is an urgent need to look at retrofitting Glen Canyon Dam to operate at low levels.
There, you mentioned in your reporting that there are some experts who are saying that maybe it's time to actually just phase out Lake Powell. How seriously is something like that being taken? Because I want to get to the question of what that would even mean. Like, what would it – what is left if you phase out a massive dam like that, one that backed up nearly 200 miles of the Colorado River, one that took 17 years to fill? Like, what's in there? It's full of silt and crap right now, right? So what would it even mean to phase out something like that?
If we were to fully phase out the reservoir behind Glen Canyon Dam, we would get the largest river restoration site in the world. It would be messy. It would be complicated. And it would be incredibly beautiful. We're already getting a taste for what it looks like because we're seeing that restoration happen on the main stem Colorado River, for example. We're seeing that restoration happen in the hundreds of side canyons. I mean, the ecosystem of Glen Canyon was decimated when that dam was built. But it's also ripe for restoration, right? So what happens when you see this reservoir recede is that these canyons are filled with sediment, right? The main stem tributaries, all the side canyon tributaries, once they flow in, they're all carrying this huge sediment load. The sediment drops out and leaves these deltas that are left high and dry, right? So you have all these big piles of sediment everywhere. But because there's so much naturally flowing water in the tributary rivers and streams,
it's an ecosystem of itself, of its own.
It is. And that sediment actually flushes out really quickly in a lot of places. And the ecology rebounds in a really impressive way. This is the way I like to put it. When we're talking about restoration in Glen Canyon, we're talking about sediment moving and ecological succession. So we're seeing these ecosystems come back, and they're coming back faster than anybody ever thought. So if the question is, will we ever see Glen Canyon the way it was before the dam? The answer is definitely no. It'll never look the same. There are sediment deltas now that will probably be there for hundreds of years, if not longer. And, you know, the river channel might have picked a new path. But for most of Glen Canyon, it's not covered in sediment. Most of the sediment that was deposited is in the upper third of the canyon. So right now, there's all this area in Glen Canyon that doesn't have any sediment in it. So depending on how this reservoir were to be phased out, the potential for restoration is really big.
Let's go back to the Bureau of Reclamation and what now they're doing in response to the realities on the ground. You say the Bureau's drought response plans, for example. It's an interesting read you mention in your writing. And they don't, in fact, and I don't really understand this, they don't actually mention the term climate change. So is the Bureau of Reclamation sort of in denial about this, or what is that? What is that about?
It's a complicated answer. I think for a long time the Bureau has had a hard time incorporating the realities of climate change into policy, and I want to be careful not to throw the Bureau under the bus because they're not bad people, and I know a lot of those people, and they're hardworking individuals. The Bureau is kind of a broker between states with different ideologies and different goals. And I think that might have pulled them in different directions and sometimes underplaying climate change. In 2012, the Bureau released a really large study that was meant to assess this impact, the potential impact of climate change. And it way underplayed the severity. It underplayed the severity of climate change far too much. And I think that's part of the reason why we're so behind now where we are. And so – and a lot's happened since then. That was written in April, and I think – you know, the big development now was that just a couple months ago in June, the Bureau of Reclamation came out and they said that the basin has to conserve 2 to 4 million acre feet of water and they have to come up with a plan in 60 days. On the higher end, let's just think about this for a second, 4 million acre feet, that's a third of this entire river system. They're saying you have to somehow find a way to conserve that water and have a plan in 60 days. That is a seismic amount of water and a ridiculously short amount of time. And we could speculate about why it took the Bureau so long. You know, why didn't they say 4 million acre feet years ago? Like, why did they do it this year? And I can't help but wonder if these plumbing limitations inside Glen Canyon Dam, we mentioned that earlier, right? Once it goes below Power Pool, the Glen Canyon Dam can't release enough water downstream to meet that delivery obligation. Mm. So we talked about Power Pool. We talked about Deadpool. There's an elevation that doesn't get a lot of press, but we should start paying attention to it, and it's around elevation 3440, and it's the elevation at which the dam can no longer release enough water to meet that delivery obligation. The delivery obligation was the main reason the dam was built.
Yeah.
Catch excess water, meet the delivery obligation. And so there's a lot of question about, you know, with this kind of outdated plumbing inside Glen Canyon Dam, is that why the Bureau is now making these huge, you know, Herculean efforts to prop up Lake Powell? And even before this call to find 2 to 4 million acre feet, the Bureau of Reclamation and basin states are going to great lengths to prop up this reservoir. They're releasing 500,000 acre feet from Flaming Gorge upstream. They're holding back 480,000 acre feet from Lake Mead. They're giving – it's effectively a big stimulus to Lake Powell. Even with a million acre feet extra this year, it's still running a deficit. It's still going to drop down to within 15 feet of minimum power pool. And, you know, you got to look at this and say, what's the plan here? What are we going to do? For a long time, this idea of retrofitting the dam to operate it at low levels, it was kind of looked at as like, that's crazy. We'll never have to cross that bridge. You're crazy environmentalists. You just want to drain Lake Powell, you know? And we're in a situation now where pretty soon it's going to be beneficial to all stakeholders in the basin to start looking at how to reoperate that dam.
Where does a pipeline from Lake Powell to feed the growth of Washington County, where does that even fit in the scheme of things?
When you think about this proposal to divert more water from the Colorado River to pump to Washington County, which by its own measure, right, their numbers that they used in the EIS that's going on, they say they use 306 gallons per person per day. That's more than double what most cities use in the West. So by their own admission, they are one of the most wasteful counties in the West. And they are proposing to pump 86,000 acre feet out of the Colorado River at a time when the Bureau is saying, hey, this whole basin has to conserve 2 to 4 million acre feet. And
it's just – it seems impossible, right? Like
there's a little bit of cognitive dissonance there, yes. I would say that, yes, it does seem impossible. And it's unfortunate that the state of Utah has spent $30 million in studies on pushing this pipeline through at a time when, you know, the Colorado River is on a sort of lifeline. We need to do everything we can to help this river. We don't need to put another straw in the river.
Eric Balkin, he's the executive director of the Glen Canyon Institute. His article about Lake Powell and Glen Canyon appeared in the Deseret magazine earlier this year. You can find a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
We understand. You don't really want to turn off NPR Utah, but you're busy. You've got no choice but to leave your radio behind. Well, why not turn to KUER's podcasts? You can take a deep dive into politics, the Utah way, with State Street. Or maybe you're feeling wildly curious, in which case, check out the latest episode of Radio West. And don't miss Sent Away, our investigative podcast about Utah's troubled teen industry. Learn more at KUER.org/podcast.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the future of Lake Powell. The environmental advocate Eric Balkin is our guest. In the spring, he wrote a piece for the Deseret magazine where he explored the history of the Glen Canyon and the dam that covered it with water. And Balkin says Lake Powell is a shadow of its former self. And still, developers and leaders are hoping to get billions of gallons from the reservoir every year to feed the explosive growth in Washington County. And all of this comes at a time when experts are saying it may actually be time to think about phasing out Lake Powell entirely. But could you even do that? And what would that be like? So in your writing, you mentioned a couple of options. We've talked about one of them, the idea, you know, what do you do then with this reservoir? Do you manage it as as you put it, a semi-forgotten holding tank that seasonally oscillates around its minimum release? That's one option. Or another option you mention is, what if we reimagined it, you say, as a kind of national park, or we think about it as a monument? With, and this is how you describe it in your writing, the river flowing around the dam, kept in place as kind of a backup facility, but we're thinking differently about it. How realistic is that image that you have of the lake, of Lake Powell?
If you had asked me that question 5 years ago, I'd say it was really far off.
Yeah.
But you're asking me today, and I think it's more realistic than ever. And I understand that there's going to be a lot of resistance to this idea because people love that reservoir. People love Lake Powell. And I understand why they love Lake Powell, right? That reservoir is in one of the coolest canyons in the world. So, of course, it's going to be one of the most beautiful reservoirs in the world. The same would go for the Grand Canyon downstream. Of course, there were two proposed dams in the Grand Canyon that weren't built, thank God. But if they were, would those reservoirs have been beautiful? Yeah, they would have been amazing, and they also would have been a crime against nature, right? It doesn't mean that it was the right thing to do. So I understand why so many people love that reservoir, and it's really hard to imagine it going away. I mean, it's been a staple in the West for decades. But the reality is, it's already changing. This last year, there were 2 months where all the boat ramps were closed. In this coming year, there's probably going to be about 4 or 5 months maybe where you're either not going to be able to launch a boat or the Park Service is going to have to rush to extend the boat ramps even more. So this change is coming whether we like it or not. And I think it's really important that people start to wrap their heads around that. And I understand all the push from the Park Service to, you know, move marinas, extend boat ramps, kind of milk every last bit out of this reservoir as you can, you know, for recreation, houseboating, that sort of stuff. But at a certain point, there will be diminishing returns. And we need to start thinking about what comes after Lake Powell. We need to start thinking about Glen Canyon for Glen Canyon. And we should be reimagining this place as a type of national park or a national monument. There's so much potential in Glen Canyon. A lot of people look at the drought and they think, you know, doom and gloom. They think bathtub rings, abandoned boat ramps. When I think about Glen Canyon, I think about returning waterfalls. I think about newly flowing rivers and streams. I think about the cottonwood and willow forests that are reestablishing themselves. It is such a special and unique environment. Craig Childs writes about cottonwood and willow forests, and he makes the point that these desert forests are some of the rarest in North America, and he talks about how special they are. They are just coming alive in all the canyons in Glen. It's phenomenal. I took a group of stakeholders down there this spring, and we went to a place in a canyon that had been out of water for about 20 years. Around us, you know, we had a free-flowing, trickling stream going past our feet, a small waterfall. We're looking up at 50-foot-high cottonwood trees that are in the restoration zone. That area used to be under 50 feet of reservoir. And one of the gentlemen made a point to me. He looked at me and he said, "We spend millions of dollars all around the Colorado River Basin trying to regrow cottonwood trees, and they're just coming back to life on their own here." So the potential for restoration in Glen Canyon is so big, and I think people are just starting to see that. I mentioned that it's complicated. There's a lot of sediment. It's not going to be perfect everywhere, but there is so much good that's happening down there that we need to start making plans for that. We need to start thinking about how do we manage that place. Lake Powell is about 27% full today. Based off all the climate projections and the best river modeling we have, it's really unlikely that it's ever going to fill again. So what do we do with this place, right? Do we just keep it as this like shrunken reservoir, or do we start optimizing it for more of a national park style economy? And I think that transition is taking place naturally, but we need to start thinking about it more intentionally. And I think what would be most important from a management perspective is to loop in the input from the tribes. The tribes around Glen Canyon were not given a fair chance to have input when the dam was built. I don't think anybody would doubt that.
Yeah.
And there's this generational opportunity now to work with tribes and kind of share their management vision. And, you know, we took a trip with the Water and Tribes Initiative this last year. We've engaged with some conversations with tribal members, and we're really interested to see where that conversation goes. But I think there's a really big opportunity there. And people ask me all the time, they say, "Oh, well, once you lose the reservoir, you lose everything, right? Page is going to be screwed. You know, the bullfrog, these surrounding communities. The reservoir for a long time has brought hundreds of millions of tourist dollars. There's no doubt about that. But the example that I would turn to is Canyonlands upstream. Canyonlands has a very similar geography, right? It's a national park based around a river corridor. It has a variety of access points and recreation opportunities, car camping, you know, easy sites to get to that you can drive to, lots of accessibility, plenty of room for all types of visitors. Glen Canyon can be like that. Glen Canyon can be a place where everyone can visit for national park style recreation. And this isn't a fringe idea anymore. The people down there are already thinking about this. Billy Schott, the now retiring superintendent of Glen Canyon National Recreation Area, he said in an interview that if it turns into a river, there's going to be more people coming to Glen Canyon to float the river than in the Grand Canyon. So people are starting to think about it, but I think we want to be intentional. We need to optimize for this new reality. And it's going to be hard for a lot of folks to wrap their head around, and I understand that. But, you know, for the longest time, the Glen Canyon issue, it was sort of seen as this pipe dream of environmentalists. Ed Abbey famously wrote The Monkey Wrench Gang, where they try to blow up the dam, and it was always kind of seen as tilting at windmills. We're now in a situation where it really doesn't matter what your opinion of Lake Powell is, whether you like it or not. We might be looking at the last couple years of that reservoir, and we need to start planning for what comes after.
This kind of brings us back around to the story you were talking about before. It must feel on some level reassuring that, as you've said, the river is reestablishing a version of its former self.
The desert and these canyon environments, they're always in flux. I spent a lot of time trying to photo match historical photos of Cathedral in the desert and kind of going back and forth. Did the creek flow on that side? Did it flow on this side? And after a certain point, you realize it's always changing, right? It was always in flux. And obviously, having been impounded by this 700-foot wall of concrete was a change that would have never happened under, you know, natural processes. It's such a dynamic environment that is so ripe for change. You can see it happen. And a lot of people, I think, want to go out into nature to get a kind of pristine version of the world, untrammeled by man. You know, go out into wilderness and see what it looks like when humans don't mess with it. There's kind of a different opportunity in Glen Canyon where we get to say, yeah, we did mess with it and we did mess it up, but look at what's coming back. It is so fascinating. I mean, my mind is blown every time I go there, and I go there a lot, you know. And when you take people there, their mind is blown. I mean, everybody that sees Cathedral in the Desert is awestruck. I saw a video on YouTube of this Lake Powell tour guide company with this group who was fishing and checking out the reservoir, but they also wanted to see some of the sites that were coming out. And they went into Cathedral in the Desert, and they were having this reverent moment. You know, these are like Lake Powell dudes. And they're like, this is incredible. I remember my dad telling me about this when he saw it, when the lake was filling up. And it's just so fascinating to be down there. And well, there's a lot of doom and gloom around the Colorado River. I'm very optimistic about the West and the Colorado River. We have enough water to grow and prosper here. We have the tools to make it happen. And even though there's less water in the system, that might mean it doesn't make sense to store it in Glen Canyon anymore. So we have a huge opportunity there, and it's time to make the most of it.
Eric Balkin, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
That's Eric Balkin. He's the executive director of the Glen Canyon Institute. His article about Glen Canyon and Lake Powell appeared in the May issue of the Deseret magazine. You can find a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. The program is produced by Kerry Watson, Benjamin Bombard, and Tim Slover. Stephanie Allerton is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.